Well, you're almost an angel. I hope you heard that word in the text this morning. You are right now, even if you're mired in some terrible sin, even if you're caught up in some foolish behavior and you know you need to stop, even then, even if that's true, I hope it's not, but even if it is, you are almost an angel. The promise of the old poet is quite clear. You are just a little bit less than God. You are almost a divine being. Now, let's be clear, you're not perfect and neither am I. I think you knew that. But God wants us to understand that the promise we've encountered today invites us to consider the vastness of the heavens, the grandeur of the mountains, the depths of the ocean, and recognize that all of that combined is still not as great as you, because you are just a little less than God, just a little less than the divine beings, a little less, almost an angel. We read the King James this morning because, for one, the beauty of the poetry is just second to none. There are some translation issues and errors and concerns with the King James Version, but the poetry still remains hundreds of years after it was translated. Some of the most beautiful words ever written in the English language. The second reason I chose it is because the word in verse 5, that is in Hebrew, Elohim, is translated in the King James as angels. You're just a little less than the angels, almost angels. You could translate it as gods, lowercase g, or in the plural, or you could translate it as God, capital G, uppercase G. And in fact, many times in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Old Testament, the word Elohim does mean the word God. Sometimes you could translate it as divine beings, which is most, in a sense, the most accurate, but the least poetic of all of those. I like angels. It's a beautiful image. Don't get stuck in the literalness of it, but accept the poetic nature of the idea. I mean, think about it this way. If you get in trouble this week with your mom or your dad or your boss or your wife or your husband or somebody else, just be sure and remind them, okay, I'm sorry, but I'm almost an angel, remember. Somebody after the church service at the 9 o'clock service came through and said, I could almost see your halo today. I don't think that's true, but it was a nice thing to hear. There was a time in my life, and maybe in yours, when a message like this would have seemed foreign, strange. I heard growing up in the church all too often that we were sinners in the hands of an angry God, that we are in danger of being punished, of being sent to eternal torment, and you better watch out, you better be careful. You're going to fry if you don't get your life right with Jesus. Those messages, all of them, were fear-based. They were designed to keep us on the straight and narrow path, designed to keep us in line, not to think this way or that way or anything else. I began to change my mind. I remember this as though it was yesterday. I was in seventh grade. My dad, who was the preacher of the church I was in, brought in a guest preacher. My dad's sermons never went that direction. But sometimes we'd bring in guests, not sure why. And this guy got up and he said, if you're sinning at the moment of death, you will be sent to torment forever. I was sitting next to my best friend, David Visaki, and I turned to David and said, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Might have been my call to ministry began then in that moment. Just made no sense. I knew somehow in my guts there was something wrong with that. Well, after I graduated from college and before I went to seminary, I took a job in a little church in California, Central California, called First Christian Church in Hanford. Sweet little town right in the middle of about halfway between San Francisco in the north and Los Angeles in the south. I was there as a youth director, not as a minister. I hadn't really thought I would go to seminary or do all of that. I was going to be a teacher and a coach, but they offered me this job, and it was a fun one, a great one. And I'd been there about 3 or 4 months when this young person came, a high school age kid, came to our Christian Youth Fellowship Sunday school class. I had about 15 or 20 kids there that morning. She was with a friend. She walked right over to me. She said, my name is Mary. I'm an atheist. Will you still let me attend? I said, sure. I didn't know what else to say. You know, what are you going to say? Sure, you welcome to attend. Glad you're here. I said, there's some pastries over there from Macaño's Bakery, which is this great, this Portuguese family, the Macaño's owned it. Wonderful pastries. I said, after you had one of those pastries, you might change your belief in God. Just try one of those. She did not laugh. But she came back. And then I learned her story. See, every year she'd gone to Bible camp since she was in kindergarten. Every year through sixth grade. She went to Bible camp up in the Sierra Nevada mountains every summer, year after year. She loved it until fourth grade, when the speaker that year told them that if their bus crashed on the way down the mountain and it was a tiny winding road and they hadn't been baptized, they'd be sent to hell. Well, Mary was scared to death. You know what she did? She got baptized. Next year, same guy, similar message, said, if you've messed up since last year, it might still happen again. So what did she do? She got baptized again, sixth grade again. She was baptized three times in the waters of fear. She looked at me straight on and she said, I think that's crazy nonsense. I hadn't been to seminary. I hadn't really been trained. I didn't know for sure what I was doing, but I looked at her and said, I totally agree. I said, you know what? Ever since I got this job as a youth director, I've been reading the Bible and taking it a lot more seriously than I did as a kid growing up. And I keep going back to John 3:16, where it says, for God so loved. And she interrupted me and she said, wait a second. I know those verses too. And it sounds to me like those verses say only certain people are going to get it. I said, wait a minute. Just think about the first four words. For God so loved. If that's true, what kind of a God would send a fourth grade girl to punishment because her hair wasn't wet from the baptism? A few weeks later, I was honored when Mary asked me to baptize her a fourth time, but this time in the waters of love with a message of grace. Like I said, I didn't know for sure, but I felt in my own heart that somehow this God of all that is a God of love, not of fear. You know, here's the thing, though. It's kind of sad. I've told that story. Some of you may have heard it before. I've told it a few times in my ministerial career. It happened 35 years ago, and I still tell it because that message of fear and anger and punishment is still out there. In fact, if you ask the average person on the church, what does it mean to be a Christian? They'll tell you, oh, judgmental, angry, finger pointing, that sort of thing. That's why we tell that story again and again. Our church, though, since our founding nearly 100 years ago, has continued to preach a message of grace and hope. George Hamilton Combs, for whom this chapel is named, was our founding pastor. He preached this word back in the 20s and 30s. It was a strange word, a wild word. They thought he was incredibly crazy, kind of out of left field, and yet the church was packed every Sunday because the community found their way to a message of grace and hope. Bob Cuny, who was my predecessor, preached in this chapel every Sunday for 10 years. Bob Cuny was famous for saying, "You are a beloved child of God." In fact, when I interviewed for the position, they told me that. Bob says that all the time, by the way. He says it all the time. So I listened to six sermons in a row of Bob's. He said it in all six of those sermons, 6 weeks in a row. You're a beloved child of God. Why? Because we live in a world that too often gives us the opposite message. We've got to hear it again and again and again. It's a difficult one to hear. A difficult one to receive. Because some folks have wrapped God up tightly in a box named judgment. And they like it that way. They've taken God and they put God, or tried to put God, into a cage named anger. They've tried to put God into a tight little church where punishment is the primary word. It's a theology that allows them to ignore the love, the grace, and the forgiveness that is there. It keeps God locked away. Why do they do that? Well, I suppose, and I've done this myself, I suppose sometimes we want to stay away from grace and forgiveness because it feels weak, because it feels dangerous almost. It feels like we're not in control or in charge. You know, the Simpsons TV show. Some of you watch The Simpsons. Is it still on? I think it's still on a rerun somewhere. Some of you watch it. Raise your hand, please. Some of you watch The Simpsons. Some of you had. Oh, good. A few of you. You might remember Homer and Bart. Well, Homer Simpson, one episode, is watching PBS. And there's a show that he really wants to watch on PBS, but they're doing one of those telethons, you know, where they're trying to raise enough money to make it through the next year. And he's irritated and frustrated because he wants to watch his show. And then somebody comes on and says, if we can make enough in the next hour, we'll quit early so we can get back to our programming. So you know what Homer did? He picks up the phone and he calls in $1 million pledge. Sure enough, they stop it and they go back to the regular programming. A week later, PBS shows up with these funny soldiers and all this stuff. Apparently, PBS has real power. And they say, because you made a pledge and you don't have the money, you have to go serve as a missionary in the South Pacific on an island out there. They take him and he ends up working with all these church folks on an island where they build a little church for the villagers there. And at the end of it, he's very proud of the building they've constructed. He looks at it and says, we've built a nice little cage for God. This is nice. And too often, that's the way we think. If we can just keep God in a little cage over here, keep God in a little box in our little church, so that God doesn't have too much to do with us, that'll feel good. The truth is, we can't do that. Cage, box, or church, even. God's grace extends to the ends of the universe. God is scandalously ready to forgive the worst in the world. And more than that, God is scandalously ready to forgive the worst in you. That God is free and roaming about the face of the earth. That God's spirit is found everywhere, scandalously ready to love us and forgive us. There's the second thing, I think. Believing that we are almost angels can actually save us some money. I've wondered, and there might be something here. I've wondered if one of the reasons we're so caught up in materialism in the United States especially is that we don't understand that we are already God's children. Because there's this emptiness within that says, you know, who am I and what am I going to be about and how can I live this life better? In order to fill that emptiness, we buy a bunch of stuff. And I'm just as guilty. The Apple store opened in San Francisco. I saw that in the paper this morning. It's like four stories high right on Union Square. Julie and I are going to be there on vacation in July. First thing I said out loud at my desk at 5:30 this morning was, I can't wait to go. Oh, what am I saying? You know, what is it about that? What is it about getting more and more stuff that we don't need that makes us feel better, at least temporarily? If we could receive that message that we are already this close to being a divine being, to being an angel, maybe all that stuff that we think we need, that I think I need, might not be so important. I mean, think about this for a moment. Do you think if my wife took her credit card today and went to Nordstrom and bought all the shoes and all the dresses and all the jewelry that she really wants, that she'd finally be satisfied? Sadly, we'll never know the answer to that question. There's another one. This problem goes beyond the church and bad theology, too. I've since discovered that one did not have to grow up under a rigid and mean-spirited theology to have a terrible view of themselves. I've had too many conversations with people who've talked about the voice in their head that continually puts them down. Is that true for you? Some have told me that it's their mother. Others have said it's their father. Others have said it was a teacher I had in third grade, just can't get her out of my mind. Some, it's a boss, a child, a friend, spouse even. Those negative voices telling you constantly, you'll never amount to much. Who do you think you are? My friend Ted is a therapist here in Kansas City, a very good one. I've got a stack of his cards in my office. I refer people to him all the time. He will tell you that his father told him when he went away to get his degree in psychology, oh, you're not going to get a real job, are you? I've got another friend. He's my good mentor, my good friend. Pastor, large church, has done very well. His mother, not long before she died, said to him with angry voice, do you think your church will ever know what a phony and a fake you are? And here's the really terrible news. I know too many of you, too many folks in this church and in my ministry who have those same conversations. And worse than all of that, sometimes the most difficult voice you face is the one of the person in the mirror repeating those messages to yourself. That's why we preach this stuff over and over and over again. To hear the good news of God's grace that you and I are almost an angel. And not just us, but everyone who's ever lived. There's one more thing. This negativity seems to be infecting our society. It seems to have gotten worse. I wonder sometimes if we think in the church that snarkiness is a spiritual gift, you know? I mean, I've read the Bible a couple of times. I can't find snarkiness there, but it seems to be that we, not just in our church, but in the church in general and in our culture especially, we seem to criticize everything and everyone. Put-downs and critiques are the norm of the day. Take a moment, and don't spend too long on this, but take a moment later today and read an article online and then go read the comments. It won't take but four or five before name-calling and insults begin. It's just ugly. What's happening to our world? Name calling and insults seem to almost always be the result. And I got to tell you, maybe you know this already, but the worst persons to listen to sermons are other preachers. Julie and I went on vacation a while back. We wanted to hear somebody preach that we'd not heard before. And I had my bulletin out and had a pen, and I was taking some notes and making some notes. And I wasn't going to say this to him directly, but I was making some criticisms on my notes. And, this point's weak here. And boy, his exegesis, that's a fancy word for studying the text. His exegesis isn't very strong. And, his theological underpinnings for that point, that he just forced that in the Bible. That's not in there. And I was making all this stuff down. And we got in the car, and I had my little notes. I was ready to show Julie. And I turned and looked at her, and she just looked at me and said, "Wow, that was exactly what I needed to hear today." When did snarkiness become a spiritual gift? When did criticism become the norm? When did putting the other and finding a way to make them feel bad become part of who we think we're supposed to be? When we're nothing but critics, when we scoff at everything and put down the other whiny and put down the other while listening to our own whiny and cranky voices, we drown out the voice of God, the one that has been whispering since the beginning of time, "You are created in the image of God. You are almost an angel." The church today, I believe, needs to rediscover what the psalmist in Psalm 51 calls a right spirit. Tradition says that David wrote Psalm 51 after he was caught in an adulterous affair. "Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Cast me not away from thy presence, and take not thy Holy Spirit from me. Restore unto me the joy of thy salvation, and renew a right spirit within me." You don't have to have done something like adultery in order for that to be true for you, for the church, for us, to renew a right spirit, to have a spirit of righteousness, a spirit that appreciates the beauty and the joy of the other, of being alive in God's green and beautiful world. Renew a right spirit. A poet would say to us today, "You are almost an angel. Now go and act like." I suspect that most of us have had to battle one or more of these issues in our lives. Maybe that's why the psalmist wonders out loud, "What is man? What is woman? That thou art mindful of them?" It's the ancient question, the eternal question of who am I? Why am I here? Spoken in very beautiful and poetic language. Who are we that you, God, are mindful of us? Did you know that the book of Psalms, though, begins with the words, "Blessed is the one," and it ends in the 150th Psalm with, "Praise ye the Lord." Blessed and praise. In between the book, and in between those two Psalms, you can find every emotion in the book: faith, joy, hope, love, grace, forgiveness, anger, frustration, revenge, sin, more. All of it is dealt with. All of it can be found there. But the bookend of praise is a way of saying our life begins with the song and it ends in the same way. The book of Psalms, you see, is called the songbook of Israel, the songbook of the church even. It was meant to be sung. The words are meant to be sung. They're like the verses of the hymns we sing in worship. It was meant to be proclaimed out loud in a praise-filled kind of way in worship. It's God's way of saying, at the beginning of your life, at the end of your life, the angels will sing. Abraham Heschel is a brilliant theologian. He says, "The beginning of prayer is praise. The power of worship is song. First we sing, then we understand." You hear that? First we sing, then we understand. When we interviewed Paul Tucker, who played for Diane a few moments ago, as our co-director of music here at the church, we didn't quite understand his theological underpinnings. We wanted to know, what's this guy's theology? How does he approach his faith? And so we asked him a couple of hard questions. Finally, he said, "You know what? My faith is expressed when I play. When I sit at that piano, and I lead the congregation in song, that's when my faith is at its fullest." I love that answer. The search committee went completely quiet. It was a powerful way of saying our faith becomes real when we can connect our hearts to our minds. And so we sing. The Bible tells us that the angels sang when Jesus was born. It also tells us in the book of Revelation that the angels have been surrounding God since the beginning of time with song. They're going to do the same thing until the end of all ends of whatever that might be. The book of Psalms is the songbook of the church, the songbook of Israel. It begins with "Blessed is the one, and praise ye the Lord." At the end of all there is God. And you and I, we're just a little less. Just a little less than that. Amen.